The Tom Woods Show, episode 1439.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, as you know, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has been spreading some pretty terrible ideas, and she's wrong on just about everything. Well, I've put together the definitive smash of all of it. The Green New Deal, affordable housing so-called, free college, high tax rates. It's in another free ebook, yes, a free ebook called AOC is Wrong, The Upside Down World of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Grab your free copy at aociswrong.com. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. I am talking today to Mike Meharry on his podcast. Mike Meharry's been a guest on this show in his capacity as communications director for the 10th Amendment Center. But he also has a website, godarchy.org, and podcast of the same name, Godarchy. And the purpose of that podcast is to look at the intersection of Christianity and the state from an anarcho-capitalist perspective. Mike describes himself as a refugee from the religious right, and that he now looks at things quite differently in light of the non-aggression principle. And so he's got this podcast that brings together these two important elements in his life. And I was a guest on a recent episode. So you'll want to check out his podcast at godarchy.org. I'll link to it at tomwoods.com/1439. Tomorrow on this podcast, we're going to be talking to Scott Horton about the passing of Justin Raimondo of antiwar.com, who was a columnist there, the lead columnist, who wrote over 3,000 articles. It's just astonishing, his output over the years. And we're going to talk about him, his legacy, the future of antiwar.com, war propaganda, all kinds of stuff we need to cover. So that's definitely an unmissable episode, number 1440. But that's coming up tomorrow. Right now, it's Mike Meharry and me on Mike's podcast. And here we go.
Well, I'm here with the great and wonderful Tom Woods. Tom, thank you so much for taking a little bit of time out of your busy day to be on the show.
My pleasure, Mike. Thank you.
So we're going to talk a little bit about your book, The Church and the Market, A Catholic Defense of the Free Market. And I'm going to be honest with you, the book really wasn't quite what I expected, because there's a lot more economics in here than I imagined. In fact, I think Bob Murphy should quit giving you a hard time about being an amateur economist, because you could stack this up with pretty much any economics test.
Well, you know, and I could have stood up for myself, Mike, if I had any self-respect and pointed that fact out to him. But I thought, you know, if Bob wants to be a jerk in front of the whole world, I'm just going to let him dig his own grave, you know, because I figure on our cruise, we're having a debate and the loser shaves his beard and that poor guy's going to have to shave his beard. So I've been going easy on him.
Well, you're a kind person.
I let him go with his crazy rants, you know? I'm just the kind of guy I am, but I appreciate that. It's very good of you to say.
So here's my plug for the book. I think a Christian from any faith tradition is going to get a lot out of it, and really even if you're not a believer, because it really ties the idea of ethics and economics together in a really coherent way. So I think this is a much broader, you know, you hear the title and you think, oh, this book's for Catholics, and it's really much broader than that. But so you've got a Catholic defense of the free market. So how does that even work? I mean, everybody knows that the market is just greed and heartless economic calculation, right? So how do you defend the free market from a Christian perspective?
Well, there are a lot of different possible approaches. With a Catholic audience, I have to address the kinds of points that I would expect a specifically Catholic audience to make. Now, as you say, the book is not by any means just for Catholics, because it's making a pretty darn strong case for the market economy that ought to resonate with anyone.
Yeah, absolutely.
But what I have to do, first of all, is address Catholics of the left and the right. And yes, there are some people like to say, there's no left and right in the church. Have you looked around for 5 minutes? There is.
Right.
Okay?
Of course
there is. And a lot of times you'll see the left and the traditionalist right agree with each other on so-called social teaching, the Catholic social teaching. They'll say, well, the church frowns upon capitalism or this or that, the whole thing, or the church wants labor unions or whatever it is.
Right.
But when you look more closely, first of all, okay, you can find some statements critical of some aspects of capitalism. But when it comes to socialism, that is ruled out absolutely. Pius XI says you cannot be a socialist and a Catholic. Mm-hmm. Just rules it out. So that's, first of all, that's different. Secondly, in terms of labor unions, yeah, Pope Leo XIII wanted them, And we see that in his famous encyclical Rerum Novarum. But elsewhere, he made clear, now, of course, what I mean by that is that these unions would be peaceful, and anybody who wants to take a job on whatever terms he wants to accept it should be allowed to do so.
Right.
Okay, well, that cuts against the grain of every modern labor union.
Right.
So it's not exactly what people think it is. But my main point is, it's I think there is, and forgive me if the landscaping outside my house is a problem, but if a pope or anybody, could be a bishop, a bishop's conference, whatever, if somebody like that says the family really is the building block of society and a healthy society wants healthy families, therefore we need laws that provide a living wage for the head of households, well, the second part does not follow from the first part.
Right.
Because maybe the legislation undermines the employment of the head of household. And this is not raised. There's no – or the arbitrariness of determining the living wage. I mean, we consider what if I'm a head of household with seven kids and someone else has no kids? Does that mean he gets a lower living wage? Like, we're actually going to sit down and individually carve out wages for everybody? And suppose it turns out that, well, actually, I look after my ailing parents. I may not have kids, but actually, my budget is three times higher
right.
as a result of my expense. This would be, or and then when we calculate the living wage, would a Netflix subscription be included? I mean, that's not strictly required, but it is an enjoyable pastime.
Sure.
But I could live without it. So how do we factor that? It just you just get into this impossible series of problems. And so I show really how wages rise, and it has nothing to do with violence and shouting through bullhorns. It has to do with how, as capital is accumulated and economies become more physically productive, the resulting abundance of goods puts relative pressure downward on their prices as compared to wages, and your real wage and your real income and the purchasing power of your paycheck, they increase. So that's what I'm saying. So what I'm trying to do is make a distinction between general principles and their application. We can all agree on the general principle that we want to help families, we want to help the poor, we want to do this and that. But the application of that in terms of economic policy, well, that's different. I mean, the church has competence to talk in general principles about the society that it wants to see, but does not have competence to talk about the technical workings of the economy any more than you would look to the Pope to explain to you how to build a church. I mean,
right.
he may say, we want churches that look like this because we think they call to mind the majesty of God. Okay, fine, do that. But he can't say, now listen, when you're building the foundation, what I've found to be the best thing is, well, now, of course, like what that would just be superstition from
right.
a Catholic point of view.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to make that, because that distinction is not carefully made in church documents, but it ought to be.
Yeah. I think you hammer on this idea over and over again that facts aren't subject to moral critique. I think those are
right.
your exact words.
Yeah.
And you wrote, something works a particular way or it doesn't. And so I think a lot of people confuse means and ends. So saying we can agree we want people to earn a good wage, I don't know if we can say living wage because what in the world does that even mean? But we can agree on a moral ends, but we can disagree on how we're going to bring that about. And that's really what the economics thing is about. You say economics does not presume to dictate to us what our ends should be. So yeah, I think that was really the key takeaway for me, because you get this same pushback. It's certainly not exclusive to the Catholic Church. You definitely get it in Protestant denominations as well, where, well, you must be a socialist because socialists care about what, you know, well, you can care all you want to, but just because you care doesn't mean that your policy is going to bring about
right.
what you want.
Wishing doesn't make it so.
Right.
Is the point. Yeah.
So you've said before that this book, I think as you put it, is maybe one of your biggest or most important original contributions to the world. How did this come about? I mean, what was the genesis behind the book? What made you decide, I'm going to write a book about the market and the church?
Oh, because I was sick and tired of being attacked by jerks gunning for me. You know, so I decided I'm going to sit down and write this whole thing out, because I'd been writing bits and pieces in response to people who were going after me. And I felt like they were either just not understanding my argument or just being deliberately obtuse, because I would explain this important distinction I just made to you, and they would say, he's saying the church can't speak about the economy.
Right.
Well, it's a little bit more subtle than that, you know, Mr. IQ. It's a little bit more subtle than that. I was saying that the nuts and bolts, like the church wouldn't say, like, for example, suppose there was some medicine and the only way to get it was by ripping the hearts out of living children. Okay, well, maybe the medicine is a really great medicine, but I think we would all have a moral objection to how you get it. So the church could have a moral objection to getting that medicine, but the church would not be in a position to tell me what the side effects are, or you know, how best to manufacture the medicine once it's in the lab, or whatever. I mean, that we can clearly see the distinction in that case. And so I wanted to make that distinction and then just show them that their complaints are misplaced and that their complaints are really just based on slogans and it was like bumper stickers constantly. And I thought, these are smart people. These are not dumb people. So I think I'd have a chance of reaching them to get them beyond platitudes, basically.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting because I think sometimes I read a, I wish I could remember where I read this, but it was talking about people who are intelligent and have a broad base of knowledge in a given area tend to overestimate the knowledge that they have in other areas. So like a lawyer will think because they're smart and they're a lawyer that they actually know a lot about physics when they don't know squat about physics. And I think we see some of that carry over into people that are moral philosophers. They're great moral philosophers, but they're not necessarily good economists, and they mistake their ability to bring about moral philosophy. They mistake that with the ability to understand economics. And if you haven't studied economics, you're not going to understand economics.
That's the point. And I keep saying that. I keep saying that economics is an actual discipline.
Right.
You know, it's not some, you know, frankly, I've heard the insinuation, not necessarily from Catholics, but I've heard the insinuation that economics is a phony science contrived by Jews to justify greed.
Yeah.
I mean, what am I supposed to say to that?
Yeah, actually, that kind of leads me to something I wanted to ask you about. You know, can we really determine economics facts? You brought up Thomas Aquinas and his view on how we determine truth. And he talked about how we find knowledge. We can find it through reason alone. We can find it through faith alone, or we can find it through a combination of reason and faith. How does economics fit on that scale?
On that scale, economics is reason alone, because I don't think there's anything in divine revelation that helps us understand specifically how social relations work in this regard. Mm-hmm. Now we can get some basic truths. But in terms of watching how it occurs, it would be like the question of what causes rainbows.
Right.
I mean, you know, you would have to just go out and examine that. Mm-hmm. And so likewise here, I mean, especially when you get into advanced topics, like why is there a business cycle? Mm-hmm. Pope Pius XI made it seem as if what was going on in the world at the time that he wrote Quadragesimo Anno in 1931, which obviously was the Great Depression, was simply caused by greed. Which is so utterly unhelpful. Right. I mean, really, that is honestly, I mean, a guy like that with three doctorates and that's the best he can come up with, you know, goes to show the need for economic knowledge. Then why didn't we have it in 1901? Why 1931? You know, like, why was that the 1931, 32 was really the depths of it.
Right.
Why did it occur then? Rather, were just greedy people, were there more greater abundance of them?
That was the first time we ever had greed.
I think it was. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, that's right. Right. That's right. I think the first greedy person's name was Jim Houseman. He was born in 1895. Right. And he really got that ball rolling, and we've been suffering ever since. But it turns out that there are actual causes for the right. business cycle that we ought to look at. And when we realize that there are actual causes, then we can actually start – the people who are champing at the bit to render moral judgments, now's the time. Now you look and you say, well, wait a minute. If central banking has something to do with the business cycle, and the business cycle causes all kinds of havoc for families that we're supposed to care about – remember the families that were supposed to be getting us all active and excited about economic policy and how to fix it and all that – okay, well, if that really is what you believe and you're not just posturing, and then you find out that the central bank has something to do with this, maybe there now becomes a moral dimension to whether or not we should have a central bank. You know, but so I mean if all you want to do is morally condemn, I got plenty of things for you to morally condemn as long as you get the right ones.
Right. Yeah, exactly. I want to pivot back to something we were kind of touched on just a second ago, and this is the idea of church authority and in the sphere of church authority, and I think that's a kind of an overriding theme in the book. And I think some people would probably accuse you of challenging the authority of church leadership. And as you read the book, it's clear that you're not doing this. But can you kind of talk about those different spheres in a little bit more of a detailed way? And while you're at it, can you explain the idea of papal authority? Because this dumb Protestant doesn't really understand it. And I don't think it is what most people in your general population who aren't Catholic think it is.
Right. Now, if I forget any part of the question, just chalk it up to middle age and feel free to ask it.
I'm older than you, so I'll probably forget too. We'll be talking about something.
All right.
I'll remember later today.
Yeah. Take notes or something as we're doing this so we don't forget anything. When it comes to papal authority, in a way, I hate to put it this way, but it's almost like the church has itself to blame because the clarifications on this are not as abundant as they ought to be.
Mm-hmm.
And you get some super duper deluxe Catholics who think that if the Pope says his favorite color is red, then yours can't be green,
right.
You know, that kind of thing. Like you can't, and that's absurd, right?
Sure.
There's no basis for that. The doctrine of papal infallibility was codified at the First Vatican Council around 1870-ish, mm-hmm. 1871. And the idea behind it was that when the Pope speaks solemnly on a matter of faith and morals, ex cathedra, that means from the chair of Peter, mm-hmm. sitting, you know, from his position of authority, and declares that the entire Catholic population must be bound by a statement of faith and morals, that this is definitive and to be believed by everyone,
right,
and cannot commit error. So what this is following from is there had been a movement, well, at least since the Great Western Schism, where following that, that was a case where we had two popes at once, and you had people on both sides. You had people who were later canonized saints thought one pope was the correct one, and some thought the other one. So there's really, you could easily make a case for either one.
Mm-hmm.
And so it undermined papal authority in that day because, you know, the Pope is supposed to be the symbol of unity in the church. And
right.
You have two of them running around and condemning each other. Nobody knew how to get out of it.
Yeah.
And so I remember the first thing they tried to do was, all right, well, look, we'll just pick another Pope. But then the first two wouldn't leave. So then they wound up with three popes.
Right.
That's like a disaster. Right? So anyway, what wound up solving that problem was a council around 1450, an ecumenical council of the bishops of the church,
mm-hmm.
where they basically declared the other popes to be deposed and they replace them. Well, the reason I bring this up is that left in the minds of people the idea that maybe it's not the Pope who really is the final word. It really is the ecumenical council.
Right.
So it's the pendulum swinging back in the 19th century to clarify that it really, that the Pope, obviously we can have councils and the councils can make judgments, but the Pope on his own authority can make these judgments on faith and morals.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't mean that, you know, you have to believe that climate change is the most urgent, because that's an opinion. That's a matter of opinion.
Right.
Climate change is the most urgent issue facing the world today. Maybe that is what Pope Francis believes, for all I know.
Mm-hmm.
But that would not bind you in any way, because just qualitatively speaking, how could that be a proposition of faith and morals? It's not. It's a matter of opinion.
Right.
But if he were to say something like, look, I definitively say, and as John Paul II said, I definitively say, and this is for the whole church, I definitively say that the church does not have the authority to ordain women as priests.
Right.
That cannot happen. Well, all right, well, then that's that. I mean, that's the end of that. You know, the Pope has spoken. So when we're dealing with economic policy, the Pope can say something like, you know, we need to, one of the urgent tasks of a Christian of any stripe is to serve the poor.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But to then say, now, my understanding from reading this book over here is that if we pass this law, that really ought to do it. Well, okay, well, that's not really a proposition of faith and morals.
Right.
That's a claim about the workings of economic policy. And so that can't be binding on the conscience. So you would listen to it respectfully, the same way that if your father came and said it to you, you would listen to him respectfully, even if you thought he was full of it.
Right.
So it's not that the Pope's every utterance on every subject, or even his every utterance on really important subjects,
mm-hmm.
are every single one of them to be treated as if they came from Holy Scripture.
So it's pretty clear when a Pope makes one of these type of pronouncements, right? Because I think a lot of people, the common understanding is, well, whatever comes out of the Pope's mouth is supposed to be infallible. And in reality, it's really very few things, correct?
I mean, you can tell by looking at documents that they do use certain language.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like especially like the word definitive,
right?
And to be held by all the faithful. Hard to miss that. But for instance, even things like as close to the heart of the church as the liturgy, the mass itself. Well, there have obviously been disagreements among the popes.
Right.
That's clear. You can just look at that. I mean, Pope Paul VI thought it was great. I mean, absolutely great. And to be celebrated that the mass that had existed for many, many centuries and nourished the faith of many people was completely and radically changed and simplified and made into the what turned into the hootenanny you see at your local parish these days,
right.
You know, where they're going to sing embarrassing pap from the 1970s instead of this amazing musical patrimony of the church. It's like right. Romper Room. It's ridiculous what they've done. Whereas Pope Benedict the 16th, not 35 years later, was saying, yeah, this was a very radical change that disoriented a lot of people, and it should have been done differently. Well, okay, wait a minute. So if you're going to believe every word out of the Pope's mouth is infallible, what? You're telling me that 35 years ago this was a great idea, but then suddenly it became not such a good idea? I mean, you'd have to have a lobotomy to think that way.
Right.
It's just that they disagree.
Yeah. All right, here's a question for you. This will shock the world out there. Why does Tom Woods believe that a market order is morally superior as an economic system?
All right. Well, in some cases, I look backwards. I look at why do people say it's not, and then I critique that. So,
well, it's not because it's greedy.
Right. Okay. So it encourages greed.
Right.
But one of the great points Milton Friedman made in his famous interview on Donahue was that there's greed everywhere.
Exactly.
So you think in communism there's no greed? Except in communism, the greed is manifested in the activities of the apparatchiks and the hangers-on, the members of the regime, mm-hmm. and they get all the special perks and privileges, and they get buried in the special cemeteries, and they get the special health care and all those things. They get all those things. That's where greed comes in. Now, it's not that we're saying greed is good or encouraging greed, but
right.
we are noticing that it's quite normal for people's ties of affection to be limited. We don't have the same ties of affection to a stranger in New Zealand that we have to people down the street or to our family members and close friends. That's a fact, and that's not ever going to change, nor would we want that to change, because the result would be real chaos. I mean, how could I feel more strongly about a stranger in New Zealand than my own daughter?
Right.
You know, who would even want that kind of
system? Yeah, that would be weird.
Right. So the nice thing about the market system is that in order to get the things I want, I have to give you the things you want.
Mm-hmm.
And so it channels even my basest instincts into productive outlets. And that's a good thing. And then secondly, the sheer results of the system are
right.
such that the poorest are living at a material level that would have been unimaginable for the very wealthiest.
Mm-hmm.
Even, I mean, the Habsburgs at their vacation home didn't have flush toilets. You know, I mean, the most famous family name in European history.
Yeah.
So, and whereas today we, you know, some people's toilets have two buttons on them.
I know.
Depending on what kind of way you went, you know, how much water do we need to flush it down? I mean, it's just ridiculous.
Of course, the federal government tells you how much water you can have in that toilet.
That's true. There definitely is that. I remember that with Al Gore. But the fact is, if you're going to complain that, you know, we need X or Y and capitalism, if it's X or Y, what system has given it to us quicker? And I mean, every time there's some kind of technological improvement, if you were to just say, oh, this technological improvement is too expensive, let's force the price down, then they would just stop developing it and that'd be the end of it. But if you let it sit there, even something like an LCD or plasma TV, yeah, they were like $2,000 when they first came out.
Right.
Well, good thing they didn't say these TVs can't be more than $500, because then that would have been it. They would have stopped doing it. But what happened was, with competition and more technological know-how, we got to a point where everybody could get one of those if they wanted. You know, and so that's the nature of how it works.
Right.
And moreover, it's an amazing worldwide network of cooperative enterprise. It's not fundamentally competitive. How else could you describe bringing together goods from all over the world, combining them into a usable product by an end user who doesn't even know how it was produced, and it was produced by people who speak different languages, who worship different gods, who have completely different value systems, and yet somehow they produce the inputs and coordinated with each other to buy and assemble them to create that product. Well, what is that if not an amazing form of cooperation?
Yeah, exactly. And you know, to me, the most significant part of it is no violence, force, or coercion required. You know, you and I can enter into an agreement and transact business, and we could hate each other otherwise. But if we're both filling each other's needs, then nobody's going to get hit. You know, nobody's going to get punched. As you always put it, we don't have to have some overlord with a bullhorn directing traffic. It is a beautiful system of cooperation, and who doesn't want that, right?
Exactly. But you have to take the trouble to understand it.
Right.
And not just be ready to wag your finger and condemn.
Exactly. And that's what this book does. So I want everybody to go order this book. I'll put links in the show notes page. It's fantastic. And like I said, you don't have to be Catholic. The economics in this book, it's worth reading it just for that. I think your explanation of the business cycle is fantastic. I mean, I'll put it up against anything that I've read anywhere else. So
can I jump in with one? I appreciate that. I'm going to jump in with one additional point here about it, because it's, as you say, I mean, I envision it as the book people read between Economics in One Lesson and the more advanced, longer texts like Human Action or Man, Economy, and State. It's that intermediate point.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why and so it's overwhelmingly economics, overwhelmingly. Mm-hmm. And mainly because I thought that the best case I can make to Catholics is a reasonable one.
Right.
Is just to argue from reason, and which is really what the book does. I think in terms of contributions that I've made to libertarianism, I mean, mostly I'm a popularizer. I'm like Voltaire in that I take these big ideas and I explain them so that everybody gets them and everybody can spread them around. But in terms of original contributions, this is the main thing for me, is to take the issue, because people have addressed Catholic social teaching before, mm-hmm. but not really head on. The way they would do it is they would find the three sentences in the papal document that seem to support capitalism, mm-hmm. and they just quote those.
Right.
Like there's no further discussion.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, not productive, because the other side will say, wait a minute, what about the other 117
right.
sentences? You know, so that's no way to go about it. So I actually think this is the thing where and where I've pushed our position. I've developed it, worked on it, and now to the point where I never heard the kinds of arguments I was making. That's why I wrote the book.
Right.
And now I read people writing articles on this subject, and they're all making my point. And I, you know, I suppose it could be a coincidence. We all thought of it at the same time, you know, like Leibniz and Newton when it came to calculus mm-hmm. or something. But doubtful. I think I actually had an influence here. And I'm glad, because this isn't the kind of book that earns you a lot of money. It just makes you feel better that you wrote it, because that little voice in your head won't give you a moment's peace until you do.
Right. Well, I for one, am glad you did, because I think, you know, the broader case that economics isn't some kind of immoral or ungodly field of study, I think that's important for people to grasp, because that seems to be rampant. You know, he's talking about economics. He doesn't care about people. Well, really the opposite is true. If you really care about people, then you need to know economics so you understand how the system works best. And this book does that. That's fantastic.
Thank you.
So one last thing real quick before I let you go. I know you've got a lot to do, but speaking of being a popularizer, I want to just pivot just for a second and talk a little bit about war. Because honestly, the reason I started the Godarchy website, the reason I started this podcast more than anything else, is I want there to be a Christian voice that is anti-war. And in an indirect way, you're a big part of that, because you are actually the person that kind of flipped the light switch in my head that turned me from raving neocon to, oh my gosh, maybe we shouldn't be blowing up people all around the world. And the thing that you said, and this seems so self-evident now, it's, I almost feel stupid that I didn't realize this, but I think it was probably at one of the Nullify Now events that we were doing, and you probably didn't know it at the time, but I was pretty much raving neocon in those early days. And you said something to the effect of, the same idiots that are running the domestic policy that you hate are also running the foreign policy. And you know, again, that seems so simple, but it was like that light bulb went off in my head. It was like, oh my gosh. And then I really started to dig into it. And the moral implications of what was going on in the world, what, U.S. foreign policy was doing, starving children, blowing up people, increasing the conflict as opposed to making peace. I really started to examine that, and my viewpoint has turned 180 degrees. So I thank you for that, for flipping that light switch. I just want you just real quick to kind of talk, because I know that you were also kind of in the neocon warmonger stage. And if I'm not mistaken, your kind of turning point was around that first Gulf War. Can you just share what it was that kind of made you stop and realize maybe we shouldn't be engaging in these wars all over the world?
Well, I had been a supporter, because I was a kid, I was 18, of so-called Operation Desert Shield, which was, we're going to send some troops to the Middle East and just make sure that we want to keep an eye on things there. Mm-hmm. And we want Saddam Hussein to, you know, because he had invaded Kuwait, and we want to get him out, whatever. And then it became Operation Desert Storm, which is the forcible removal of Saddam's troops. And so I was a big supporter of that because I was a Republican. Mm-hmm. And so you support the military. I mean, it was just, I didn't even have to think about it.
Hoorah.
But yeah, exactly. But then when I noted all the people who died, and that we were having, you know, people were tying yellow ribbons around trees. Mm-hmm. That was the thing.
I remember that.
Your support for the troops. Yeah. And for some reason, this neocon at the time looked at that and looked at all the dead bodies and thought, all right, most of the dead bodies are soldiers. But those are still people.
Right.
And I don't have anything against these people. And I know that a lot of them were fathers. A lot of them were husbands. Mm-hmm. And these people's, those families' lives have been ruined and just decimated. And I just couldn't imagine the callousness that would be involved when this was obviously an elective war. The welfare of the United States did not depend on this.
Of course not.
I mean, if it really were genuinely the case that the United States had been really imperiled and we had fought off the invader, then I could imagine having a parade to celebrate that.
Right. You
know? But this was totally unnecessary. And I mean, I know there'll be people to say, oh, but Saddam was very dangerous. All right. I mean, we could go into that if we absolutely had to. But there's no – I can't imagine this was absolutely necessary. Mm-hmm. But even if it, I don't know, even if it were partly necessary, still there's some common humanity we share with other people. And you see that in a lot of cases where there's a natural disaster.
Right.
And people don't even know the people involved. And yet all over the world, there's an outpouring of support. But when that same foreign people gets bombed, nobody thinks, oh, isn't that terrible? They think this is our righteous justice being meted out. And if there are some mistakes made, well, those people probably had it coming. I mean, it's that suddenly that attitude takes over. Mm-hmm. It's totally dehumanizing. And I just couldn't get on board with, I'm supposed to cheer at what strikes me as a time of great sadness for the people involved. So I couldn't do it. I just couldn't. I hung on for a couple more years as a neocon.
Right.
Where else am I going to go?
Yeah.
I'm not going to join Bill Clinton.
Right.
So where else am I going to go? And it was only then that I started discovering people like Chronicles magazine, mm-hmm. where they were conservative and anti-war. And then I discovered, you know, I also was reading Murray Rothbard, and he was obviously resolutely anti-war.
Right.
And he was not a Bill Clinton guy either. These people did for me what Ron Paul did for a lot of other people, to say, you don't have to be a leftist to be anti-war. You can just be a common sense decent human being and be anti-war. And so that's what I was.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate that. And you have been a loud voice in the libertarian movement, which sadly isn't nearly as anti-war as I believe it should be. So your contribution there are noted. And, you know, to me too, that dehumanization is what really breaks my heart now. And you know, I feel like I should do penance looking back at how callous I was toward other people. And, you know, it requires dehumanization for most of the atrocities that are committed by the state, whether we're talking about war, whether we're talking about, you know, the identity politics that we see, we dehumanize others. And it's a horrible tragedy, and it's something that we need to fight with all our might. So I appreciate you in that area. So anyway,
well,
I just want to touch,
Mike,
on that.
First of all, I mean, we all feel that way and we all kind of want to reproach ourselves, but I think by doing a podcast like this, you know, you're making things right. And I've been trying to do that with what I do. I can't change the past, but I can affect the present and the future.
Right.
And that's exactly what you're doing. So good, It's terrific. You know, we're both doing what we can.
There you go. Well, I'll let you go. I know you've got a lot on your plate today. If you want to real quick, just go through whatever links that you want people to go to follow Tom Woods. You do so many things. We could probably do like two pages of links, but hit the highlights and we'll close this out.
When would you say this episode is likely to be released?
This episode will be released, I think, on June 28th. So it's going to be toward the end of the month.
Okay. Well, in that case, I'm going to mention an ebook that, as we record, is not yet out, but will be absolutely by then. I have an ebook called AOC, meaning Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. AOC is Wrong, subtitled The Upside Down World of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
Oh, wonderful.
And it goes after her on every major crazy thing. And I love it. I'm so happy. And I'm giving it away for free. So you can get it over at AOCIsWrong.com. Can you believe I snagged that domain name, AOCIsWrong.com? The beautiful thing about that, Mike, if I may just say before we wrap up, is that at the time I got that, people were not yet calling her AOC. She wasn't going by AOC.
Really?
I picked AOC because, well, I couldn't do Cortez is Wrong because her name is not Cortez. It's
right.
Ocasio-Cortez. But that's too many letters and too liable to be misspelled. So I didn't know what to do. So I thought, oh, I guess I'll just have to take her initials. AOC is Wrong. And then she starts being called AOC.
Oh, my gosh.
Calling herself AOC. And I thought, this is like a reward from heaven.
Cha-ching.
Yeah, I couldn't believe it. She's the sucker who sold me this domain for $10 must be kicking himself right now.
Right? That's incredible.
So that's what I would recommend. Go get AOCIsWrong.com, and then I'll be able to reach out to people after that because you got to give me your email address to get that book. But it's going to be so worth it.
Oh, absolutely. I tell you what, you say this all the time. I will attest to it. You want to be on the Tom Woods email list, both of them, actually. I always enjoy every email that I get. And
thank you, so, Mike. I do my best.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time and appreciate all that you've done for the movement. Appreciate your friendship. And I'll let you go. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Mike. All right, folks, I cannot emphasize enough, the best ebook I've ever produced, it doesn't cost you anything, is the brand new one, AOC is Wrong, The Upside Down World of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. So whether you're having trouble responding to her on healthcare or free college or high taxes or the Green New Deal or whatever it is, it's all in there and just done to devastating effect. So you got to go get your copy. Doesn't cost you a thing. It's over at AOCIsWrong.com. Man, have I been waiting to be able to pull out AOCIsWrong.com and say, yes, I am putting that to good use. So please, please, please go do that. AOCIsWrong.com. You will be glad you did, and I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of The Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.